I'm Stephen M. Hall, MD, an integral physician.
And I'm Grace Porter, a licensed psychotherapist. And together, we're the 7 Tools, a company focused on your personal growth and transformation.
And you are here with us for the Change for Good Summit. This year, we're focusing on building resilience in anxious times.
This summit is full of deep conversation and practical advice. We hope you enjoy this interview.
So now let's dive in.
Hello, and welcome back to the Change for Good, Building Resilience in Anxious Times Summit. I'm Grace Porter of the 7 Tools, and I'm here with Erica Curtis, who's a licensed marriage and family therapist, as well as a board-certified art therapist. Erica is a respected practitioner, writer, and speaker on innovative approaches to emotional and interpersonal health. Erica maintains a psychotherapy practice in Orange County, California, as well as teaching at UCLA Arts and Healing. Erica has been featured as a parenting, relationship, and wellness expert in over 50 media outlets, including PBS, the Boston Globe, Elle, and USA Today. Past faculty at Loyola Marymount University, past director of the Board of American Art Therapy Associations, and past president of the Southern California Art Therapy Association, Erica presents widely for universities, school districts, mental health organizations, businesses, and more. She's working currently on a creativity-based workbook for the Foundation of Art and Healing to address the loneliness epidemic. She's also the author, along with Ping Ho, of The Innovative Parent, Raising Connected, Happy, Successful Kids Through Art. And today, Erica and I are going to be talking about eco-anxiety and how to build resilience in yourself, as well as in your kids, in a world where the future feels uncertain. And just as mounting global problems require innovative solutions, so does addressing our anxiety to those problems. While staying informed and talking about concerns or taking action may help, these approaches to addressing eco-anxiety can be insufficient when trying to soothe the complexity of emotions about our collective future. Today, we are going to be talking about generating creative approaches to fostering a new kind of relationship with your anxiety in order to calm and even transform this challenging feeling. Special attention is going to be given to guiding listeners and helping their children, teens, and young adults in their lives to cope with their own feelings of dread, responsibility, and overwhelm. This is going to be a really important conversation for our times, I think. So welcome, Erica. I'm really happy to have you here with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, really, really excited that you're here to join us for this conversation. It feels like a really important piece of the conversation of anxiety at large right now. It feels like something that's running in the background for a lot of people. So I'm glad that we're bringing it out into the light.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I actually use that metaphor with some people, either that there's, like, if you think of your desktop and you have certain programs that you're using, right? And sometimes that program is open and it's actively sort of present and in front of us. And for a lot of people, it's just one of those programs that's kind of draining the battery and you don't see it, but it's just there running.
Doesn't mean it's not impacting you.
That's right. It's running in the background and it's draining the battery of the system. So whether it's at the forefront or in the background, right?
It's still there.
Yeah.
So can you tell, I mean, I know I just read your intro, but can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and your background and how eco-anxiety shows up for you in your work?
Sure, absolutely. So I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist and an art therapist. I have a private practice. My background, though, was working in what we call in California non-public schools. So they're therapeutic schools for children who were not successful academically or behaviorally in mainstream public education or even in private schools. And so the school districts are required to provide a free and appropriate education for those children. And so the district pays for them then to go to a therapeutic school. So I was working at schools for children with learning disabilities, ADHD, autism spectrum disorders, depression, anxiety, and working with parents there as well for close to a decade. I was a therapist, clinical director there, and then having my own children, I ended up leaving nonprofit and needed a more flexible schedule, so opened my own private practice. So in terms of how it shows up, like I mentioned before, sometimes it's really at the forefront, people coming in, and especially on social media nowadays, more so with adults, I would say, adults coming in with, very active concerns, reading things, posting things, getting very tied up in anger, anxiety, depression, around personal issues in their life, but also then compounded by these more global and social issues that they're engaging in, typically online. With my younger populations, with the kids and the teens and really the young adults that I work with, and that I also have the opportunity to teach sometimes, I'm hearing just a global sense of burden, responsibility. I was recently doing a guest lecture actually on suicide prevention at a university locally. And I remember one young man, we did some exercises, and one young man mentioned just how there were a number of large global factors that he felt like were his responsibility, and that he felt a giant weight on his shoulders, but that he had to do it, that he had to take care of these issues. So I think it turns up in that way as well. Like I said, sort of the program running in the background versus it being more in the forefront.
Yeah. And before we get too much further into the conversation, I did want to just bring to the forefront that idea of eco anxiety and what it actually means. It's a pretty new term, so there may be people who aren't familiar with it. And so what are we actually talking about when we say eco anxiety? And I know there's a number of other terms that get used in its stead. A lot hasn't really solidified as one particular term that's going to be used in the public eye.
Yeah, it's a fairly new term. It's a very new term. And it's a term, eco-anxiety is a term that describes basically a general sense of anxiety about ecological disasters, threats, impending doom of the future of our planet. And I think what's been going on is that more and more clinicians are seeing people turn up in their offices, their practices, their clinics with, even if it's not the initial presenting issue that they're coming in for, that it is at the very least compounding a lot of the issues that they're experiencing. It can lead to a sense of, or compound a sense of helplessness, of loss. Now, of course, there's people who are more directly impacted and have been directly impacted by ecological change. People who have been in natural disasters, droughts, been directly impacted by immigration, food source changes. So those are more direct impacts of ecological changes that people are experiencing, really specific, significant loss, PTSD, loss of home, loss of land, loss of loved ones, and that's worldwide, that's here in the United States. There's indirect and there's direct impact. So people who have been directly impacted by ecological change through natural disasters and immigration and whatnot. And then indirect are people who may not have had a direct relationship with a natural disaster or a direct experience with a natural disaster, but are aware of the changes and feel helpless to do something about it, are afraid for future generations, feel guilt even over what has been happening and what we have done to our planet. And then there's interesting information also out there being generated about sort of suspected mental health issues that we can anticipate as we continue to see ecological changes. For example, there's been a lot of evidence that supports increased aggression with increased temperatures. And a lot of people aren't aware of that, so not necessarily seeing a lot of people with that active concern, like, oh no, as temperatures increase, we're going to see more aggression. However, there is a potential impact down the line of seeing even more mental health difficulties due to changes in climate.
Yeah, so it's a really wide and varied thing that we're talking about when we're talking about eco-anxiety. It can be everything from having lost a home to a fire or to a tornado or whatever, or to, you know, whether or not you're choosing to get a sleeve and straw with your coffee in the morning when you go to the coffee shop.
Like that's right. That's right. And I think an important piece for our listeners is that however it shows up in your own life is significant. Something to pay attention to. Because I think sometimes people also can compare themselves and their own experience and their own relationship to ecology and to the planet, to the changes that we're all experiencing. And they may minimize their own experience or minimize other people's experience or judge their feelings about it. It's complicated. And I think that that's one of the reasons why eco-anxiety has also become an issue, not just because of ecological changes that people are worried about or directly experiencing, but also then how we judge our own feelings about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's almost that, this is something that is in one way or another likely living in almost all of us. And so how are we becoming aware of it in our own lives, and how are we, what are we doing to support ourselves in those feelings and also in the choices that we're making on a day-to-day basis? Is that
That's right.
what you're saying? Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Because I think like any type of anxiety, right, there's a bit of a sweet spot where we can exist with some discomfort so that we don't become complacent, but that we don't become so anxious about the situation that we become impaired to help ourselves or help others or to help the environment, right? And so it is sort of being able to not ignore the feelings or ignore what's going on, but also not becoming so incapacitated or so overwhelmed by the feelings of fear or hopelessness, or the symptoms of PTSD, for example, for people who have directly experienced natural disasters, that we can find that sweet spot of stress or discomfort or anxiety and tolerate it so that we can mobilize and take whatever steps we can personally take in our own lives and in the lives of our community members.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm listening to you, I'm kind of thinking about the becoming aware of what we have some control over, what we have some influence over, and we don't have influence over we don't have control over what nature is doing, but we do have control over the choices that we're making in our day-to-day life. And so it can build that sense of being empowered, or that sense of that we are doing our part in a greater system when we're able to make those choices in our own life. And to do that, we have to be aware of what we're feeling and how what's happening with the environment is impacting how we're feeling.
That's right. That's right. There's interesting research that suggests that the belief in one's own resilience has been correlated or is correlated with fewer symptoms of PTSD or depression after disaster. So if we just believe that we're more resilient, right? That if we have that piece of our identity, like I can handle it or I can move through difficult times, that belief alone is correlated with less symptoms after a problematic event.
Yeah, that totally makes sense to me, because when we think about beliefs, they both shape what we see, but they also are shaped by what we see. So if we believe that we're more resilient, we're going to experience ourselves as being more resilient, because we'll notice the things we'll notice the places where we are more resilient.
Right, right.
Yeah. So finding that sense of agency can be really important, it sounds like.
Yes, yes. So at some point, perhaps now, or maybe we'll save it for later, I can even sort of do a bit of a guided experiential that if people amazing. Would like to do it at home, people who are listening, that I would love to have the opportunity to offer that. Because as I think you said in the introduction, there's a lot of things that you can look up, you can see that there's lists of things we can do, right? How do we build resilience? How do we cultivate a sense of meaning and purpose? How do we cultivate a sense of agency in these changing times? And there's a lot of pretty standard ones. Moderate your use of social media. Is it helping you to feel better, or do you feel worse afterwards? Do you feel like you're making a change or impacting the community by voicing your opinion, or do you feel more depressed and lonely and angsty afterwards? Right, so we can check in with ourselves in these ways. I'm doing something local, doing small things you mentioned before. You know, do I use the paper straw? Do I use the plastic straw? Small things that we can do in terms of a sense of control. So I think there's a lot of really common tips that you can find online easily by looking up, even looking up eco-anxiety or how to manage anxiety about environmental change. And I think there's some lesser known or, lesser known strategies or techniques that people can do to really work directly with their anxiety that are very accessible to everybody. And so perhaps we'll have the opportunity to do some of that as well for the audience.
Yeah, I think let's maybe save a little bit of time at the end so people can kind of roll out of that and back into their day.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I think that sounds wonderful. Yeah, so we talked a little bit about what eco-anxiety is, but I'm wondering if you can speak to how someone would know whether or not it's something that applies to them. How do I know if I have eco-anxiety?
Right. So I think eco-anxiety shows up in a lot of different ways for different people. And I think for some people, the term eco-anxiety might not resonate. And so I think really just taking a moment to check in with oneself and say, what are my concerns or to what degree do I worry about my future, my children's future, my grandchildren's future, or the future of the planet? And is really going to be different for different people in different communities for several different reasons. Some communities are more directly impacted by ecological change, and other communities are less impacted. Some people are more actively aware of, either through their consumption of media or other filters that have stronger views or have more information about the changes that are going on in our world, and other people avoid it or are less exposed to it. So I think really for each person to check in with themselves and to say, what comes up inside of me when I think about the future of my community, when I think about the future of my children's children, when I think about the future of the world. And then just to notice that, because for some people, it will feel like a sense of helplessness, loss, or impending loss, dread, doom, could be to that level. And for other people, it'll be much more mild. For other people, it'll be more like that program kind of running in the background that they'd rather not notice. Or maybe they really feel quite disconnected from it and don't feel at all like it's impacting them. And that could be problematic as well, either because it's something that is running in the background, draining that energy, but not being addressed, or it might have a larger impact on people around them and on their relationships and on their community if people are ignoring these feelings or information of what's going on. So I think classically, eco-anxiety really talks about the more extreme side, right? People who suffer PTSD, people who have a sense of impending doom or loss, or guilt, and that it's really impacting their sense of well-being and their happiness. But I think it's important to look at mental health along a spectrum, a broad spectrum, and to say we all experience anxiety and that we all experience varying degrees of anxiety about a variety of issues in our life, including some of these larger issues having to do with ecological change, and to check in with where you're at, because that's significant as well. I think that it's important to raise awareness by doing things such as calling this eco-anxiety and looking at all the problems around not just physical concerns, but mental health concerns around ecological change. But I don't, I'm cautious to sort of exclude other people who would maybe say, well, that doesn't apply to me, click, because it really applies to all of us.
Yeah, so it's a matter of how much or how aware we are of that the program is running for us.
Yes.
Listening to you, I was thinking, and I just want to say this because I feel like it might be helpful for some people that, you know, in psychology, we often talk about anxiety and depression as being the different sides of the same coin, and that like where there's one, there's often the other. And it sounds from what you're saying when you're describing eco-anxiety that for some people it may be showing up more on the depressive side than the anxious side, that there may be like those feelings of doom or hopelessness, like feeling really just stuck.
Yes. So a lot of times what happens is that in terms of you know, two sides of the same coin. Another way to think about it is in terms of our nervous system activation. If you think about a fight, flight or freeze, right? When we're confronted with a danger or a threat, the system is designed such or has developed such that if we are faced with a threat, we want to fight it off or run away from it. And if we can't do either of those, then we go into a freeze state, which is playing dead in the animal kingdom, right? I can't run away from the tiger. I can't fight off the tiger. So I'm going to play dead and hopefully it'll leave me alone. And if it doesn't, and I'm going to be eaten, then at least I won't feel the pain of it, right? And so that's depression. Right? The playing dead is depression. The anxiety is the fight flight. That's the flight, right? Oftentimes the anxiety association with fleeing, but it can also be fight, right? So that's the nervous system getting ready to activate. The heart rate can increase. If we start talking about somatic experiences of anxiety, the heart can start to race. We can sweat. We might feel jittery. Our breathing might be more shallow, right? We're taking in more oxygen to oxygenate our muscles so that we can, you know, increase muscle tension so that we can fight things or run away from them really quickly, right? So we're getting ready to mobilize. A lot of times what happens is people get into such a state of mobilization and then they think, or not necessarily consciously, but unconsciously, but I can't do anything. So then they go into a depression or a depressive state. And that's that sense of hopelessness, helplessness, right? I can't do anything about it. And so I'm going to numb out, right? And sometimes we start to engage in certain behaviors also to assist in that numbing, isolating, drinking, drug use, you know, other things like that contribute.
Yeah, just kind of shifting into a state of denial a little bit for some people maybe also.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. We're shifting into a state of denial or not wanting to turn towards it at all. Even on a mild, again, on a mild level, like I don't want to watch that documentary. I don't want to read that. I don't want to know about it. La, 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 la. Mm-hmm.
Covering. That is too heavy on my heart. I'm going to avoid.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. And again, everybody has a different inclination, I think, towards how much, you know, news or information they want to read or expose themselves to anyways. And there is no right or wrong. Again, it's finding that sort of individual sweet spot of how much is okay for you to tolerate. And would it be helpful for you or others around you if you connected a little bit more with that? And can you connect a little bit more with that? Meaning that being what's going on, ecologically speaking, without jumping into the fight flight or falling into the freeze state.
Yeah. So listening, it sounds like there are points where consumption of information might be flooding for people, or it might be too overwhelming for their system. And so there may be a need to pull back and not be exposing themselves so much to all of the information around all of it and all of the feeling and the fear and the sadness and everything else that comes up for people around us, like backing up a little bit and yet not backing up so far that there's disconnection from the feeling or denial of the feeling, repression of the feeling. So finding that space in between where you can feel what you feel without overloading your nervous system by continuing to, and I want to like be in like the barrage of information.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, a good way to think about it is digestion, right? When we consume food, we consume hopefully a healthy amount of food, right? We don't overeat or else you feel uncomfortable. And we need to digest. We need to have time for our system to digest that food. And the digestive system takes out the nutrients and then it gets rid of what it doesn't need, right? And that's a process. And we can think about information, including feelings, in the same way. Our mind and our body takes in information, whether that's facts about, for example, what's going on ecologically in the world, or if those are our feelings about it, or other people's feelings. There's a lot of feelings in the world about, on many different sides, about ecological change right now. And so we're also consuming other people's feelings about about changes. And our mind and our body needs to digest it. And part of the digestive process is likewise allowing our mind and body to take what it needs, what is useful, and to get rid of what is not useful, right? What we don't need to hold on to.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like that metaphor or that idea of thinking about it as digest system, because right. I think that helps with the idea of titration of how much we're exposing ourselves to, but that we are still eating, that we are still aware, we are still meeting our needs of how to be both aware of ourselves, but also present and active in our communities and creating a world for ourselves and for our children and our grandchildren and our great-great-grandchildren.
Right, right. And so we can take that metaphor and go with it and say, okay, and how nutritious is the food or the information or the feelings that we're consuming, right? Where am I getting my information from? How much information am I getting?
And are you eating your dinner or are you eating somebody else's dinner?
Right, that's right. You know, do you keep picking at other people's plates? And is that filling? Is that nutrients for you, or is that giving you acid reflux?
Well, and maybe we'll use dinner as a segue into bringing our kids back into it, because I am wanting for us to talk about how eco anxiety might be showing up differently for adults than for children, and are there different skills that we need to manage it at different ages, because what's appropriate for an adult isn't necessarily appropriate for a child, but that doesn't mean that these realities are not also present for the children.
That's right. Yes. And I have several thoughts on that, starting with, you know, just how kids receive their information. And again, that's very different in different families. I think the first piece is to be very aware of how much children are sponges and how much they take in of the information around them, whether they are directly or indirectly exposed to information about ecological changes, whether it's because the news just kind of is on in the background in the living room and kids are hearing it, or teachers are talking about it at school, or children in communities that have been directly impacted by natural disasters. And so there's a variety of ways that children can be impacted and in a variety of degrees. But I think that the important piece is for adults to be very conscious of the fact that children are to some degree aware and are being exposed in a variety of different ways, subtly or less subtly, to ecological changes. I mean, even things like, you know, the polar bears are dying. That is a fairly commonly known fact now. And to think about how that little person brain processes that and understands that. And one thing I always like to go to, just from a brain development standpoint, is to acknowledge that the cortex of the brain, the outer part of the brain, which is the thinking, planning, organizing, sort of rational part of the brain, we now know that that doesn't fully develop until we're 24 to 26 years old. So if we think about really how a child is operating, it is really from that fight, flight, freeze part of the brain, the instinctual part of the brain that protects. It's from the amygdala, the part of the brain that is responsible for emotions, mm-hmm. right? The limbic system, which is that middle part of the brain. And certainly they have a cortex, but it's not fully developed. And so when we talk to children and expect them to be able to understand information the way that adults do, we're really barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, it's not hitting that part of the brain first.
That's right. And they tend to be much more concrete thinkers. They tend to be much more literal than we are. And they really do also live in this world of more fantasy. And they don't connect the dots in the same way that we do, for better or worse. In some ways, that mm-hmm. can be helpful. But to tell a child, for example, that the polar bears are dying, we don't really know unless we really check in with them what that means to them or what that looks like in them to their own imagination, how that could be impacting that child.
So being aware of how we're presenting information and making sure that we're holding space for the emotional components as well as the factual pieces, and that the children might be soaking up our emotional reactions to something and not just the words that are playing on the TV or the actual storyline, that what they might be getting is the emotion of the situation without all of the storyline.
Right. What are they walking away with?
Yeah.
Right? I think that's really the basic question, is when children are, one, that children are probably taking in more than we acknowledge or that we're aware. And two, what do we really understand about our own children's meaning making around it? And that's the important piece, the meaning making, not necessarily the facts, but what meaning do they derive from those facts, because the meaning that we make about those facts are not necessarily the same meanings that the child is making about those facts or those pieces of information.
Yeah. So really making sure that we're checking in with them.
Yeah. What does that mean to you? What are your thoughts about that? And empowering children. I mean, we're talking about resilience, right? Mm-hmm. Empowering children. And this is one of many places that children can start to learn and practice resilience, right? Being able to hold space for the fact that this is sad or uncomfortable, and what can we do about it? You know, I have a 6, almost 7-year-old daughter, and she is a diligent beach cleaner upper. And it's not, you know, we've done beach cleanups as a family before, but it's something that she's really attached to. And she will, if we're at the beach, she will just bring me trash. She'll just run over and go, "Mommy, I found another piece." And she'll just plop it down next to the, and she's not upset about it. She's not distressed about it, but she's very aware that trash in the ocean is harmful and it's going to hurt the animals. And that saddens her. But she doesn't carry the sadness because she feels empowered to do something about it, right? And it's something that she's just sort of taken upon herself to pick up the trash and to bring it. And I always reinforce it by saying, "You are a helper to the planet. You are helping the animals of the ocean. Look at you go." And really reinforcing that she does have agency and that she can make a difference.
Mm-hmm. What are some other tools that you would maybe offer to parents in helping their children address these feelings or these realities, these facts?
I think with children, it's important to, and adults honestly as well, to find something doable. You know, this goes back to, you know, maybe some more traditional ways of addressing the issue. What can you do? What can your family do? What do we model as adults as well in terms of choices that we make, and not just making the choices, but actually verbalizing the choices as we're making those choices, right? So for example,
why?
That's right. So for example, I go and I get my coffee, maybe from the coffee shop, and I have a choice right there to put a plastic lid on it or not. And I might choose not to grab the plastic lid and just be careful not to spill my coffee. But rather than just doing it, I might say, you know what? I don't think I'm going to put that lid on there because I know that that's going to go into the dump. So I don't think I need a lid today. And you don't need to make a big deal about it. You don't need to go into, because the world is falling apart and we're going to, right? You don't need to do that. You know, we don't need to catastrophize. But just a simple act such as that, or whatever we might choose to do. Oh, we're going to turn off the lights. We're going to, you know, here in California, we're very used to drought conditions. And so from very, very young children, and probably elsewhere, you know, but are trained to turn off the water.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're brushing your teeth, turn off the water. We're conserving water. We want to save the water, right? And so it just becomes more of a habit rather than necessarily something that's attached to a great sense of doom or, you know, but it's just something that we can all do. Everybody does it and it's helpful. So I think modeling and also naming what it is that we're doing when we're doing it and why.
And attaching a value system to it.
Right. And attaching a value system to it, right. Because that also teaches things not only about efficacy, agency, but also that we care for our community and we care for the world. We don't just think about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's a family value. That's a family value that we can reinforce through these acts.
Yeah. Which on a side note helps build the sense of belonging and counteract loneliness, which is a separate epidemic that we will not talk about today.
That's but right. Added bonuses. For another time. Maybe next year you'll do the loneliness summit.
Maybe we will.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we know that. We know that children, it's important for personal mental health to feel connected, to feel a sense of belonging to others, to feel that we are all meaningful contributors to our family, to our community, and to the world. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just a global issue. It is really a personal issue that when we cultivate in ourselves and in our children a sense of resilience, a sense of agency, and a sense of connection and belonging and purpose, we're living longer. You know, I mean, if there's no other reason to practice some of these things, because you know, certainly there's people who are like, oh, you know what, like an extra plastic lid isn't going to make a difference in the grand scheme of things. And okay, that's you know, some people believe it won't. Mm-hmm. Other people, it's important to them to believe it will. You know, so there's a spectrum of beliefs there. But to speak to what you're saying on a very personal level, and on a health level, when we feel like we are connected and that we are a part of something, we actually live longer. We actually have more sense of happiness and pleasant moments in our lives. And who doesn't want that?
Yeah. Well, and bringing it back to what you were saying at the beginning about the eco-anxiety piece too, it does seem like it would, like when some of the anxiety is coming from that sense of the world being out of control or not having the capacity to make it better or to have it not hurt us, like to protect ourselves against it, making those smaller choices, those are the things that we do have some agency over. Those are the things we have control over in our own life, like do I choose the cup or put the lid on the cup or not? You know, am I saving water? Am I not? Those are the places where we can build that sense of maybe we're doing something which will kind of help reduce the anxiety a bit as well.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And, or even, you know, if you want to connect on a larger scale, depending on what your access to and what your own resources are, but for children as well, to raise money from a lemonade stand to donate to one of the many, many wonderful initiatives out there for clean energy, mm-hmm. For example, and to teach children that there are not just that there are all these, you know, terrible things happening, but there's a lot of really positive things happening. Really positive, really just mind-blowing, innovative, creative folks out there who are changing the world. And that those are people doing that. And that there are also ways to support them, writing letters, drawing a picture, sending it to them, you know, or like I said, having a lemonade stand and raising $20 and sending it. You know, for children, it's just important to feel connected in some way to those initiatives. And those are ways that children can feel like they're making a difference as well.
Yeah. Listening to you, I'm reminded when I was in elementary school, we did a trash-a-thon every year where we would go around to our communities and we'd raise money the way that you would for a swim-a-thon or whatever, read-a-thon. And then we walked every Tuesday through the park and around the lake to the library and the pool. And we would, one day a year, we would pick up all of the trash that we found. And it was this like really empowering feeling for us as a school. It like built community within the school. And then we raised money. I don't remember what we did with the money, but it was this feeling of like, yeah, like we're doing something good.
And that's right. Yeah, that's right. It builds a sense of identity, right? And really, that's one of the major tasks of childhood, and especially adolescence, right, is developing a sense of identity. Who am I? Who am I going to be as a person? And so when we give kids creative opportunities to not just listen to and talk about the facts of what's going on, but actually engage them in active participatory, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be an event. It could just be, like I said, drawing a picture for somebody that they're going to send it to. Or, you know, if they hear about people who have had an experience with a natural disaster and they want to send a letter of support, or even making a sign for their door, you know, like zero emissions here on my bedroom door, you know, like no carbon emissions, right? I mean, I remember as a kid, you know, there was a big shift from smoking to in restaurants or in public places, mm-hmm. right? That was going on when I was a child to no smoking and no smoking sections. I mean, at the time it was just, oh, now restaurants are going to have no smoking sections. And so it was a new thing to see all these no smoking signs everywhere. And it was a real paradigm shift for people. But I remember making signs that said no smoking and having them on my desk at school and having them on my door in my bedroom. And it was just a way for me, I think, as a child to make sense of this change that I was seeing and feeling connected to, you know, this kind of in my own little kid mind, you know, like remembering being in restaurants and not liking the smell of smoke and feeling like, oh, this is a good thing and I'm going to make these signs, you know, but by creating them, really integrating that sense of connection and identity, right? So kids need to do things, not just hear information and talk about it. Talking is important, but we can do so, so much more with children in order to really access the way that they learn, the way that they digest information, right? By putting it in context and allowing them some creative opportunities to express themselves.
Yeah. And it sounds like there really are ways to connect to that energy of helping or participating in the solution that don't necessarily expose the kids to all of the content or the terror or the like the pieces that may be a little bit too much for them at their developmental age, that there's like a titrated way to be involved.
That's right. So going back to our metaphor of eating and digesting food, right? That we give kids portions that are appropriate for their size, that we give them, you know, even if they don't like it, we still put a little bit of broccoli on their plate and encourage them to just try it, you know? So likewise, titrating that information that they receive as much as possible. But again, I mean, I hear from parents also, you know, you asked earlier how this shows up in my practice. Oftentimes it's also parents coming in and saying, my child is having a hard time going to sleep. She is talking about this thing she saw on the news and she can't let it go. What do I do? And so that's how it's showing up as well. You know, she saw this natural disaster on the news and she saw, or she heard about it and she, or somebody at school told her that, did you know that kids are dying in such a place? And, right. And that impacts them. And so when they're taking in that information and their minds and their bodies really aren't well equipped to handle that on their own, we need to help them. We need to help them to digest that information.
Yeah. I'm thinking about too, like what happens developmentally in later adolescence and like early 20s, where there is that, like that fired up energy that's very developmentally appropriate, but that, you know, that like that activism is kind of how it shows up for a lot of people, that like really fired up is coming up again. So I'm just going to call it that, like that, that powered, empowered, I'm going to go and make the world a better place. I'm going to do this. I'm going to have an impact.
Right.
And that is going to be showing up in kids and it's very natural for it to be there. And so finding ways for them to connect to that are still supportive of themselves, that are not like running them down maybe, or I don't know if you.
Yeah, I think.
I'm going with this.
I think what you may be speaking to is sort of like all that mobilizing energy, like we talked about before, that the system is built to mobilize us, especially in the time of a threat. And when I say threat, just to clarify, it could be a threat or a perceived threat. It could be a physical threat or emotional or a relational threat. Mm-hmm. Right? And our mind doesn't differentiate between those. And so I think what you may be speaking to is sort of this mobilization of energy to do something about injustices, to do something about, you know, and it might feel like a personal threat to well-being or to relationships or to justice in general or what is right or wrong. A lot of that's coming online. And And even there, helping those young adults, those teenagers and young adults, to be able to feel like they can then channel that energy to feel a sense of empowerment and agency, not I'm all revved up and I got this agency and I have nothing to do with it.
Right.
Right. Or where do I put it and where does it go now? And does it end up being destructive or does it end up just burning out because I've got all this energy and now I feel helpless because really I can't do anything about it, right? As we continue to develop that cortex of the brain and more sort of thinking and analytical thinking comes on, that can also add to those very complex existential thoughts coming online for the first time and questioning meaning and questioning the place in the world. And that can be very... we've been asking those questions forever, forever, right? And then we have these, you know, young folks who are asking these questions, and it's a very normal and natural process, but it can also be very scary and very overwhelming, paired with, at that time, kind of having all this mobilizing energy of, okay, I'm launching into the world, right? I'm getting ready to become an adult. I have all this momentum, not just developmentally, personally, but also like you were talking to, sometimes can come out in terms of activism or wanting to change the world, wanting to really impact, and moderating that with what can you impact. And that can be very devastating at times if there's a sense of, oh, I can't really change anything. And so again, we want to titrate it. We want to help them to digest all that information and really find a way to funnel that energy so that they do feel like they're making a difference.
Yeah.
So hopefully that can continue, right?
Yeah. And it strikes me also that the helping them build those skills earlier on, so by the time they developmentally get to that energy, they have the skills and the agency and the value systems in place to feel the empowerment, to feel the agency, to feel the ability to make an impact in whatever ways they're actually able to, so that it doesn't feel as much like they're drowning when they get to that desire to do it.
Yes, yes, ideally, right? And also at the same time, because I think this is new for a lot of us, right? And as parents as well, trying to figure this all out. I also hear from a lot of parents, you know, my kid's 13, they're 14, they're 16, they're 18, they're 22. What do I do now? Right? Like, I haven't been doing that. I maybe we should have started earlier. I've actually been shielding them, or I've actually been, or I think I gave them too much too soon, or right, whatever we've been doing as parents. So yes, ideally, if you have young ones, right, starting early. And I always tell parents, and if you haven't, and that's okay, or if you feel like you've given too much, or you feel like you've shielded them too much, or wherever you fall, it's always okay to say, I'm going to hit the reset button. And I can hit the reset button as a parent. I can hit the reset button as a family, and just to speak to that and just to acknowledge it and say, you know what? I've been noticing that you've been having questions and I haven't really known how to answer them. And I'd like to be able to start practicing answering those questions. And I noticed that, for example, the other day you brought up this that you learned at school, and I'm wondering if you'd like to do something about that now, or whatever it might be, right? There's always the opportunity to start and to change behaviors, start practicing new behaviors. And you know what? That's good modeling as well, because that teaches that wherever we're at in life and however we may have been dealing with things in the past, that we can say, you know what, I've been feeling kind of hopeless about this, or I've been kind of, right, if maybe you've even been projecting that feeling or that sense in the home, that you can say, you know what, I've been noticing that I've been feeling kind of down about this. You notice that I watch the news and then I feel kind of mopey. You know what, I think I'm going to do something about that feeling. I think I'm going to fill in the gap, right? I'm going to start learning how I can, you know, do something in our community to help our local community, for example, or, you know, whatever it might be. So again, that comes with the modeling, right? So you can always hit the reset button and start practicing new habits and introducing new values into the family system.
Yeah. Well, and acknowledging that maybe sometimes your reaction might be different than the reaction of your kid. So you might be falling more in the denial or in the panic and immobile, or into like the panic and feeling extreme about it. And that your kid might be showing up differently than that, and how the interaction between your response and their response might be like a third thing that needs attention.
Absolutely. I think that's an excellent point. I think, you know, parents who even wish for a certain response from their kids, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, perhaps you're somebody who is, aware and you're listening to this and thinking, oh yeah, I digest this information, I titrate it, I have agency and I want my kids to do the same. And they just have no interest. They don't want to hear about it. They want to go out and play, mm-hmm. right? And that's okay too. They're kids, mm-hmm. right? That's okay too. And there's still little ways without hitting them over the head with it to, again, introduce those values, those family values of simply thinking of others. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really what it comes down to on a really core value level is this is about thinking of others, thinking of the larger community, thinking of the planet and caring for it.
Yeah. So I'm imagining that in your book, The Innovative Parent, The Raising Connected Happy and Successful Kids Through Art, that maybe you kind of talk about some of these things. Is that true, like the skills that parents can use with their kids?
Yeah, I think that there's a chapter that addresses managing behaviors, right? Conflict and sort of behavior, like the day-to-day, right? Mm-hmm. In the home and how we can introduce more creativity and art practices in order to do that. The premise being, again, that, when we're talking to children and expect them to talk back, that we're really missing a big part of how children learn and engage in the world and in relationships. And that there's a lot of really quick and easy creative strategies that we can use in order to connect more quickly with our children and to help them move through difficult emotions more quickly than if we just tried to reason with them or reassure them verbally, right? There's lots and lots and lots and lots of parenting books out there. And what I realized was really most of them are about how to talk to your kids. Mm-hmm. And as an art therapist myself, it was interesting because I found that I was talking a lot to my kids at home. And I was, as any parent, right, running up against some chronic issues with parenting my own kids. And I had this sort of, light bulb moment where I thought, why am I talking to my kids so much? Why am I, in my office when I meet with parents, I meet with children, I use art and I use more creative means of engaging and helping kids to understand problems big and small and feelings big and small. So why do I keep talking to my kids? And so I started to integrate more really quick little simple drawings or things like that to illustrate points I was trying to make or to help my kids to identify their feelings about certain things. And in so doing, as an art therapist, not surprisingly, I was like, of course they're responding to this. Of course this is helping them. And of course we're moving out of conflict a lot faster, right? Like, honey, I want to talk to you. Go away. I hate you. I don't want to talk to you, right? But I do a quick little drawing and slip it under the door and he opens the door and he hugs me, right? And so there's all these little sort of tricks and tips that are grounded in art therapy to help parents manage conflict, deal with the day-to-day, but also help their kids to process emotions. And that's really what we're talking a lot about today with eco-anxiety in children, is helping kids to manage their anxiety, helping kids how to deal with their fears. But the book covers all sorts of different emotions and different scenarios, sibling conflict. I mean, it goes into all kinds of different things to really show parents the gamut in which we can use creative activities and drawing in order to help kids to connect and resolve conflict and to understand their emotions.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like also to help the parents address the things that are maybe hard to talk about.
That's right. And to help parents as well. And I go into that in the book that, when something's activating for us, right? When something's difficult for us, and that might be because our children are coming at us and triggering us or calling us a name directly, that's hard. That's really hard to manage. And when we put it on paper, it becomes almost like a third party in the room, right? Like the paper, if you're drawing, for example, becomes the messenger of the feelings or the content or whatever it is that's being communicated. And, I think what's difficult, and this is what I hope the book will also address is parents don't really know what to do with that. Okay, my kids drew this. So I told my kids to draw this picture and they drew
now
it.
Now what?
Like, now what, right? But the book also goes into how do you ask questions about it? How do you talk with kids about it? And that kids don't necessarily need to address things as head on as we like to as adults, and that sometimes they're processing through metaphor, for example, and they might be drawing a picture of aliens or the squirrel family or whatever it might be, but that there's ways to talk about that art and create stories about it and to ask questions to allow our children to process these themes that they are really trying to wrap their heads around. And so the book goes into that as well. Like, yeah, sort of then what? So they drew this picture, then what? And there's lots and lots of different suggestions for activities, but there is one particular section that talks about anxiety and fear in particular. But the book itself covers everything from, you know, strategies for learning at school using creative activities to dealing with sibling conflict, difficult emotions,
Sounds like quite the resource.
Yeah. That's and helping ourselves too. There's also, like you said, helping parents to soothe their own feelings.
Yeah, that feeling of being stuck of like, what do I do now? What do I do with this is so immobilizing as a parent sometimes. So having somewhere to turn for some ideas or...
That's right. And there's a lot that we can do even internally using visual imagery or color for ourselves to soothe and to regulate so that we can regulate our children, right? Because when we're feeling spun out about something, it's very hard to help our own children to regulate their feelings about it. And a lot of times it's their feelings that are spinning us out.
Right. Someone's got to get a foot on the ground at some point.
Right. Yeah. And I talk in the book about, you know, connecting before communicating. And that's a big piece that we miss, whether we're talking about anxiety about the planet or anxiety about anything, right? A test at school tomorrow or a conflict in the family, that we want to connect before we communicate. And there's lots and lots of ways that we can do that. If we come at it straight with the idea of, okay, we need to talk about this, or we're going to solve this problem, or let's strategize, mm-hmm. We're really skipping over a big component that allows kids to feel safe, to feel heard, to help themselves connect with themselves, mm-hmm. right? And understand their own emotions, because that's a big task of parenting, isn't it? Is to help kids understand, this is what I'm experiencing, this is the feeling I have, and to be able to make meaning of that and to feel like they can handle it. And that's a big problem that I see nowadays. More and more kids, teens, and young adults coming in feeling like they can't manage their own feelings.
Yeah. I think it's really important to make space for that, especially when we're living in a world where we are exposed to so much information all the time, and the pain of the world is really present for us. If we're not able to hold space for our own emotion or help our children hold space for theirs and learn how to do that as children, then the world becomes a really overwhelming and scary place really quickly.
Right. That's right. So one strategy, for example, that comes from the book that, you know, I gave to a mom friend of mine, her daughter was having some anxiety and she was trying to reassure her and talk to her about it and it's okay. And right. But the anxiety wasn't going away, because you can't rationalize with anxiety, really. Mm. You really can't rationalize. Like, anxiety by definition is irrational because it's a feeling. Right? I mean, it might be grounded in some true factual experience or true facts about, you know, the world or whatnot. But anxiety, it sort of masquerades as rational thought, right? That's the interesting part about anxiety, is it's an emotion. And by definition, it is irrational, but it masquerades as rational thought. And so what we try to do is we try to rationalize with anxiety, right? We try to convince it not to be anxious. And the more we try to convince it to not be anxious, the more anxiety is like, oh, you're not getting it. And it just grips and it grows and it's right. It sort of becomes a beast because it's saying like, oh, you don't understand
how they yell louder.
That's right. You don't understand how dangerous this situation is. And we're like, but it's not, it's okay. And it's like, oh no, you don't understand. Right. So we're trying to rationalize with an emotion. And so we're speaking two different languages. And so when we drop into the language of emotions, which is sensory and somatic and a lot of times visual, that then we can start to really help kids get some perspective on their emotions. So what I suggested that she does, and this is something that parents can try with their own kids at home, whether it's about anxiety or any challenging feeling that they're having, is to draw a picture of that feeling, right? As if the feeling was some kind of a character or a form. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really important that parents don't assume that the feeling is a monster. And I think that that's something that society that we've come, I mean, even I've seen books, right? Like the angry monster or the, you know, whatever, the volcano in my stomach, or, you know, that there's all these metaphors that we sort of impose upon children. And to know that the child will have their own image and their own metaphor. And so parents can invite children to draw a picture of that feeling to get a little bit of distance from it. Right? Mm-hmm. So if that feeling were an animal or a person or a character or even just a shape or a color, right? Yeah. What would that look like?
Personify it. What is it? Yeah.
That's right. And so then they can draw it. And once they draw it, once they personify it or externalize it, now they can have a conversation with it. Right? Now they can talk to it. What are you saying? What does anxiety say? What does the fear say? Right? And they can do a little speech bubble or a little thought bubble, and you can scribe it for them if they can't write or if they can write it themselves. Right? Mm-hmm. And now we can have a dialogue. And if we want to, we can bring in a helping part. Right? Now, well, what would help anxiety or what would help worry? Right? And then we can draw another part that could come along and say something reassuring. So the child learns to reassure themselves, mm-hmm. right? By sort of developing and growing these internal parts of themselves that can come in. And now there's a visual attached to it as well, right? Yeah. So then in the future, when they're feeling anxious or worried, then they can say, oh, it looks like worry's visiting you right now. Mm-hmm. Right? Let's talk to worry. And so they are not their worry. They get a little bit of space from it. They can have a dialogue with it. They can bring in another part of themselves that has something helpful to say. And at least with, you know, with this friend of mine, when I suggested that she have her daughter draw her worries, she texted me, you know, shortly after probably. And she said, hey, that art thing worked.
Surprise!
You know, she'd been trying for days and days to convince her daughter that it was okay. And she just, you know, one picture later and she's like, she totally dropped it. She was fine after that.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes things just need a voice.
That's right.
So I did want to just name something that I was hearing in what you were saying for the listeners. And then we've got our last question. And and that was just the what you were talking about. Those are the skills of building resilience, right? The ability to feel something and then to still feel agency, so that there's space for both the feeling and also for the feeling that you can do something.
That's right.
That you're not stuck. That's right. A definition of resilience. So our last question that we're asking all of our speakers is if they could give three concrete tips for the listeners to help with anxiety or perhaps in the conversation that we're having, and eco-anxiety in particular, like what that might be, and maybe what you just said might be one of them. So maybe two more.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think one of my concrete tips will maybe be a little bit of the experiential that I hope to lead.
Awesome. So one more. It's getting easier and easier for you. The pop check, quiz check. Is getting smaller and smaller.
Well, again, I think that, you know, we talked about doing something, right? That when the feelings are saying, when the feelings come, whatever those feelings might be, is to, just like we talked about with children, to do that for ourselves and to say, why are you here? What would you like to tell me? What do you need from me? Right? And that can be through writing. That can be through just a check-in in our own minds. And perhaps that is saying, you know, I need to feel like I need to do something about this. Right? And then check in with that. Like, okay, what one small thing, I guess this is the takeaway, right? What one small thing can I do today to make a better tomorrow? Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that that's really what it comes down to. What one small thing can I do today? And if that one small thing is not doing something, that's okay too, right? That the doing might be a not doing. It might be changing a behavior from being online more to being online less, to consuming more media to consuming less media, so that your body has the time to digest the information that it's taking in. So again, it can take out what it needs that is nutritious to your mind and body, and fuels agency rather than taking in too much, so that you end up with the, you know, the food coma on the couch and you can't do anything.
Paralyzed by the food consumption.
So, what one small thing can you do today to make a better tomorrow? Because I think when we feel overwhelmed by our feelings, or we feel overwhelmed and we don't know where to start or what to do, breaking it down into just one thing today, just one thing, or one thing this week. If one thing each day is too much, start with one thing this week. What's one thing this week that I can do to make a better tomorrow? And that could be a better tomorrow for you. It could be a better tomorrow for your family. It could be a better tomorrow for your community. It could be a better tomorrow for the world. Mm. Right? And oftentimes those things are all connected.
Yeah. Things are not as separate as we think they are.
That's right. That's right. Right? Because if, and even if that is, you know what, this week, the one small thing I'm going to do is I'm going to really highlight an important value in our family. And I'm going to point that out to the kids. You know, or I'm going to really focus on that myself, you know, giving to others, decreasing waste. You know, that's one small thing I can do. And for some people, it might be, you know, bigger or smaller than that even, right? It's all relative, but there's no value judgment on how big or how small that one thing is.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your thoughts on all of this. I think that it's a really important and helpful conversation that we've been having. And I really love your idea of an experiential experience for the listeners. So I think that we'll maybe do that, and we'll leave them with that as we get to the end of our time today.
Great. That sounds wonderful. So, you know, clearly everybody who's listening in is coming from a different place, a different space in their life, different ages. So what I'll do is just invite everybody who would like to participate. If you would like to, you can close your eyes if you're comfortable doing that. If you would prefer not to, then leave them open, right? And just take a moment to settle in to your own experience, maybe just being aware of whatever has been stimulated inside of you during this conversation, or maybe during some of the other conversations you've been listening to during this summit, and just taking a moment just to see what rises to the surface. And for some people, that may be pleasant feelings, or feelings attached to thoughts that are more pleasant. For others, it might be distressing or challenging feelings attached to thoughts that are challenging or distressing. So whatever is present, just acknowledging that that is okay. And now what I'm going to invite you to do is to see if whatever is present, if it takes on a color or a form or a texture. Not trying to figure it out, not trying to reason with it or decide, just allowing it to take on whatever color, texture, or form comes to you. Now, if this is a pleasant experience that you're having, just noticing and watching that color or that texture or form, and just noticing what happens on the inside as you focus on it, seeing if it would like to move, seeing where it lives inside your body or outside your body. If it is a distressing feeling with a color, texture, or form attached to it, just taking a moment to see whether or not it feels tolerable to be in its presence. And if it doesn't, allowing yourself just to move away from it a little bit, or asking it to move away from you just enough that you feel like it's more tolerable. And then just noticing how that feels in your body. Now, if you'd like to, if you haven't done this already, inviting a pleasant color, texture, or form to enter, making space for it. If you already have a pleasant texture, color, or form, asking it if it needs anything more, if it would like to do anything more, or if it has any words, meanings, or beliefs that it would like to bring into your awareness. And if it's an uncomfortable feeling or thought that you're working with right now, asking it also what it needs. And whether or not it would be willing to make space for a little bit more calm or a little bit more energy. Whatever might be a pleasant or even neutral experience that you could bring into the field of awareness and what that might look like as well. Making space for both. And now taking a moment just to offer some gratitude to your internal world for allowing us to visit. Thanking it for being present and for making itself aware. Appreciating whatever is there, regardless of whether it's pleasant or distressing. Knowing that all of these feelings and thoughts are part of us and carry information for us to help us on this journey in life. And if you'd like to stay here another moment, feel free to do so. Or whenever you are ready, feel free to orient back to your room or your surroundings in whatever way feels most comfortable to you. And if you would like to, from this space now, you can get on with your day. Or if you would like to take one more moment and just see if any new thoughts, meanings, or beliefs float into the mind, even if it's just one word that you'd like to carry with you the rest of the day, just take a moment to find that now. And thank you for your practice. Thank you for sticking through that. Yeah. What was that like for you, Grace?
That was really nice. Just felt kind of settling, like what came out with something that felt like it didn't have a lot of space, but that it was like there, but without a lot of space. And so just kind of giving it some space felt really, really good for it and for the rest of me.
Yeah. So, and people might have had a lot of different responses, and some people might be saying, I didn't feel anything, it didn't work. You know, go back, play it again, experiment with it, right? The idea really being to make space for whatever feelings arise, right? Giving it a color, texture, form so that we can really see it and work with it. It's very hard to work with something as nebulous and amorphous as a feeling or a thought, right? But when we can make it tangible, then we can work with it. We can move it. We can see it. We can manipulate it. We can push it to the side or ask it kindly to move to the side to make room for something else, right? Mm-hmm. We can actually do something more physical with it. And so I think that that would be in terms of the three strategies, right? That's that last concrete strategy mm-hmm. that people I hope will walk away with is that if you're feeling stuck, if you're feeling overwhelmed, take a moment, manifest it in some way, either literally, physically, or in your mind. Mm-hmm. Imagine what it looks like if it were to take on a form and see if that changes your experience of it. When you can really see it and work with it in a more physical form.
Yeah, it just allows us to interact with it a little bit more directly.
Yeah.
I like that. Well, thank you so much for your time today and for sharing all of this with us. I think that it's a really important conversation to be having, and that we, like you mentioned at the beginning, this is something that impacts all of us. And so making the space for that within ourselves today is, it's important.
Yes. And thank you to you and all of the listeners who have joined us for their interest in this topic and just the potential, right? The potential for our own increased awareness, our own increased agency, and how we can impart that to younger generations, right? Mm-hmm. And to me, that's just a wealth of hope. And I joke, but I'm kind of serious. There's a plant in my office, and I kill plants. Like, I don't do well with plants. I wish I had a green thumb, but I don't. But the plant in my office where I do therapy, it is thriving. Hmm. It is thriving. And people will comment on it. Like, I've never seen a plant look so good. And I said, you know what? It's just all the healing and all the good work going on. And people really showing up, because people will say to me, you know, you must see the worst of humanity in the profession that I'm in. And I said, you know, in some ways I do. But I see the best in the best, the best of the best in people. And when you see that, when you see the depths of goodness and
our ability to heal,
our ability to show up for ourselves, our ability to show up for each other, it just keeps growing and growing. So,
I see that. I agree. I experience it that way too.
Yeah. So thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you for being here.
Great. All right.